climate issue around these big fossil fuel infrastructure projects, there does definitely seems to be more working together among the various activist groups in Portland and perhaps around Oregon.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that it's Oregon is a state right now, and the people in Oregon are pretty firmly against having fossil fuel export in our state. And I know that KBOO has done a great job of covering all of those fights before. And I think that, this LNG is a pretty major and serious issue right now, but that, like, groups are continuing getting together. And I think that, I think that we're setting ourselves on a track of maintaining that thin green line, as they like to say, around fossil fuel export in the whole state.
Okay. Well, it looks like we're just about at time. So thank you, Emmalynn Garrett, speaking to us by phone, who impersonated Governor Brown this morning at the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. Thank you so much, Emmalynn.
Thank you so much for having me on, Paul. Thanks.
Okay.
And you are tuned to KBOO Portland. Up next is Right to Survive Radio, Right to Dream 2. But first, check this out.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Nosh for Nonviolence fundraiser on Thursday, October 22nd from 5 p.m. until midnight at participating Portland area restaurants. Nosh for Nonviolence is a collaborative fundraiser for two local domestic violence intervention agencies, the Portland Women's Crisis Line and West Women and Children's Shelter. Again, that's Nosh for Nonviolence fundraiser on Thursday, October 22nd from 5 p.m. until midnight. You can find the list of participating Portland area restaurants at kboo.fm. on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The Western Regional Advocacy Project is celebrating 10 years of fighting for affordable housing and against the criminalization of people who are homeless. KBOO is a proud co-sponsor of the RAP 10-year anniversary concert featuring Mike Crenshaw, Saturday, October 17th at 6 p.m. at the Independent Publishing Resource Center. RAP is a national leader in both street outreach and grassroots organizing against homelessness. KBOO will be live streaming the concert from our website. Again, that's the RAP 10-year anniversary concert, Saturday, October 17th, 6 p.m., at the Independent Publishing Resource Center, located at 1001 Southeast Division Street in Portland. For more information, go to kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under KBOO Community Events.
You're listening to Right to Survive Radio on KBOO 90.7 in Portland. I'm Ibrahim Mubarak of Right to Survive. On this show, we go to Ground Zero, Portland, Oregon, and report news and stories that corporate media don't cover. We'll bring the uncut reality from the perspective of the unhoused community.
This is Lisa Fay with Right to Survive Radio. R2S Radio goes into the houseless community, making their voices heard, speaking to individuals on subjects that directly relate to their daily struggles.
Somebody help me.
That's work.
This is not healthy.
Man.
I am not wealthy.
What I do, have the power to break the chains.
Welcome to another edition of Right to Survive Radio, and you're back with me, Lisa Fay. This is part two of our U.S. Social Forum 3 San Jose series. We have a split show for you. First, with fellow activists networking for change, not just nationally, but globally as well. Both Jim and Norm stand against injustice and for human dignity. They came, as we at Right to Survive did, to to the U.S. Social Forum in San Jose back in June to educate fellow activists about the struggles dear to our hearts while uniting in solidarity and learning about other organizations that also work against oppression, corporate greed, and degrading humanity by stripping away of human rights. In part two of our show, we will hear from Robert, the unofficial mayor of the jungle, and a lady who was housed shortly after its dismantling. I'll come back to talk a little later more in depth about the encampment. So let's go ahead and get started with our piece from the U.S. Social Forum 3, San Jose, and the building of organized power, changing the landscape of our world.
This is Ibrahim Mubarak from Right to Survive Radio on KBOO 90.7 out of Portland, Oregon. And today, San Jose at the United States Social Forum 3. And I'm here with
Jim Haber.
Hey, Jim Haber, what brings you to the Social Forum today?
Well, I live in the Bay Area. I'm from the Bay Area. I've been a social justice activist since the early 1980s. I was even at the first U.S. Social Forum in Atlanta and the one in Detroit. So this one being here, I couldn't stay away. And I came also giving a presentation for an organization called WorldBeyondWar.org and gave a presentation. We're challenging the whole institution of war and trying to support and bring together people who are taking on pieces of it, which is important to focus and take on pieces, and also people from other issues that sometimes separate off from the problem of militarism and war, even though they're all connected. So women's struggles, the environment, social justice, justice for people of color all around the world, domestic violence, it all actually has connections to the gargantuan emphasis we place on militarism and making war and preparing for war. So I came specifically to present for World Beyond War and have a workshop. I'm also part of Jewish Voice for Peace, and we have a table. So very active in support of Palestinian human and political rights from a Jewish perspective, from a human rights perspective. So I'm here because I'm from the Bay Area. I'm here because I just believe in all the causes together, and specifically for World Beyond War and Jewish Voice for Peace.
What do you hope to get out of coming here to this social forum? What do you hope to receive, or what are you looking for?
Well, it's an important, good, positive charge to be around other movement people. And sometimes we don't want to preach to the choir, but sometimes we need to come together in mutual aid and solidarity. So there's that. The ideal of the social forum, I think, still not quite realized like we hope, but the ideal is that there's a lot of cross-pollination, that people from different movements will come together and learn about our common struggle and common needs. And I think there's been some of that here, even though it's a much smaller affair than the other two that I went to. This is much smaller, but I do feel like there's some of that cross-pollination happening in some ways more than I even experienced, because a lot of times we get a lot of people together and then we find the people that are working on the same thing that we're working on, and that's important. But I think part of the vision is also to realize that we're in this together, even people working on seemingly different issues.
And what do you hope to give? Not just receive, but to give.
Thank you. Well, I did lead a workshop, and it was great that some high school students came in and was able to engage with them and ask questions of them. And to, you know, sometimes high school students are kind of shy. Sometimes they're very loud, but the shy ones sometimes, you know, a simple question, no pressure, pulls people out. So that was actually rewarding yesterday a couple times in the workshop. Just building community. I've been receiving information here in the intergenerational workshop. I know in Jewish Voice for Peace, sometimes the youth and the less youthful, sometimes we need different spaces, but it's important not that we totally separate off. So trying to learn how to do that intergenerational blending without it just being separate.
You know, the big headliners in the world news today, it's the TPI, fast tracking, and the war between Israel and Palestine, poverty. So are people receptive of you when you said that, you know, Jews for peace?
peace, you know, and you don't agree with what's happening in Palestine, and everybody's not anti-Semitic.
Well, I think, sadly, with the Gaza assaults and the massacres last year by Israel in Gaza that continue in different forms and continue in the West Bank, I feel that Jewish Voice for Peace, JVP.org, has increased. People are more receptive, actually, to Jewish Voice for Peace, realizing that there are a lot of Jewish perspectives out there that aren't supportive of Israel, even as the U.S. State Department equates criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism, and we in Jewish Voice for Peace are organizing against that and against the University of California system taking the State Department's definition of anti-Semitism. And so we're building around that, and there's support, and now there's a flotilla going to Gaza, and so, you know, we support that. We support the boycott and divestment and sanctions movement as articulated by Palestinian civil society. So I feel like Jewish Voice for Peace is actually welcomed, and people are realizing it's important not to assume that all Jews are supporting Israel. There's still a lot of room, a lot of work for us to do still. We're doing it, and I think the receptivity has been really good.
It's just like all houseless people, not drug addicts or alcoholics or pimps or prostitutes.
We have to be careful not to lump people together, and if someone fits a certain stereotype at first, we have to be open to people not being that, and celebrate or just accept that people are not who we might first perceive them to be.
Now, do you see a kind of trend or action, how things is happening on the Gaza Strip, how this country is utilizing that and creating war on poverty here in this country?
Well, I think in general, actually, I think the government has a war on the poor, war on people of color. And I think that Gaza is, to some extent, used as a testing ground for different means of social control. I think Naomi Klein articulated that very well, and others and Palestinians and some Israeli scholars for sure, too. So I'm very concerned about the people of Gaza and their lack of water and electricity, their port. They don't control their own borders. It's terrible. And I do think that some people in different governments are looking to that as a terrible model on which to build, and we all need to watch that and be aware of that.
Well,
yes.
I don't know if you're aware, I was in Detroit 3 weeks ago, and that's what they're doing to gentrify the whole city. They cutting people water off or raising their water bill to like $700 a month and stuff like that.
I remember some of the water struggle was going on when the U.S. Social Forum was there, and I remember, and then it upped the ante when they were cutting the water off, and water is a human right, and I know that, in fact, a workshop this morning was dealing with that, and I think that's, we were in that workshop together, and that's a really important development, that international pressure needs to be applied on the United States. U.S. exceptionalism is a terrible thing, that U.S. acts like it's above the law, in any law, pretty much. So I think it's really an important example, what's going on in Detroit, and that we need to support the people of Detroit in their struggle and let them know they're not alone, and as much as we can, we got your back.
So again, you said your organization believe in social justice, and can you tell me the difference between social justice and socialism?
Well, I think social justice is a broader concept than socialism. I think of socialism as a economic system, and social justice is just acknowledging that we all deserve to try to live our lives as best as we can. People want to just take care of their families, by and large. Most people don't want to be political. They don't really want to be organizers, and that should be okay. We need good organizers, but most people just want to live their lives and take care of their families. And as much as we can as organizers, rising for social justice means defending people who, their instinct isn't to be political, but hey, we're all alive. We all have needs. We all deserve to have a good life.
So is there any one last thing you'd like to tell us more about your organization, or what we can do to help or join or look into things more on what you're doing in your organization?
Well, I do hope that people will go to worldbeyondwar.org and sign our pledge. We've been getting huge international support for a very simple pledge, and there's a strategy document there. It's growing. We're getting a lot of hits, and we're still finding getting that critical mass and critical ask, but check out worldbeyondwar.org and do go to jvp.org for information about Jewish Voice for Peace and more kind of our analysis. And I hope that people, Jewish and non-Jewish, who are concerned about Israel and Palestine will check out Jewish Voice for Peace or jvp.org to get a Jewish perspective that might surprise you, but is more common than you might at first also think.
Thank you very much.
Hey, thank you, Ibrahim. Thank you.
Paranoia strikes deep into your life, it will creep. It starts when you're always afraid. Step out of line, the man come and take you away. We better stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going on.
This is Ibrahim Mubarak from Right to Survive Radio on KBOO 90.7 FM on your radio dial. And today we're in San Jose, California at the U.S. Social Forum. And I'm here with
Norma Gallegos.
Norma, what brought you to the social forum and the polycentric social forum this year?
I am the Bay Area Radicalman organizer in San Francisco and think it's very important to be here to network with other like-minded social justice, economic justice, political justice activists, concerned folks about things that are happening in the world and in our local communities.
So I noticed here, since I've been here, I picked up a new phrase, and it's catchy, and people saying political justice. That seems like constitutional justice?
I think it's more systemic justice. So I think a lot of the issues are coming to, you know, to coming to what is the root cause of all these things, and I think a lot of people are saying capitalism is really impacting not just businesses, small businesses, but the people themselves who are in the community that are working within the system and giving their labor and giving their money to things that are not coming back to them as working people or even poor people. So I think a lot of people really think that it's no longer the economic issues that we need to fight for, but it's the entire system that needs to change and not have its direction be focused on making profits or having a business, but it's really the coming back to the community and bringing the necessities to our community.
And can you tell me the name of your organization, or are you here by yourself, and what you do or what you all do?
Bay Area Radical Women. Radical Women is a socialist, feminist, autonomous women's leadership organization. We emphasize our work around building movements for the alternative to what the system is, but a lot of the issues that women are plagued with, we politicize that. We bring leadership to women in the movements. Different women's groups don't politicize the movement to be anti-capitalist and for a socialist society. So I think what we do is a lot of our analysis comes from recognizing where movements are at and where they've been and where we think would be the best course for everyone.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear you talk about radical women and women finally coming out and speaking up, because in a houseless community, I generally tell people that we all are equal. No, it's no gender preference. We all are equal, but with different responsibility.
Yes, and I think there's just so much the way that, you know, technology has brought in a lot of different wonderful things, I mean, to our society. I think women have always been strong and resourceful. My hero is Harriet Tubman, who didn't say she was a feminist, but a lot of what she was doing was in the name of just getting there, getting some freedom and bringing, you know, black folks to freedom. But I think where women are at now is just recognizing we have no time but to keep fighting for what, you know, the basic needs that we've got. Women need water, women need mothers, we're sisters, we're daughters, we are part of the community. But we have a force, we have a say, so I think it's working collaboratively with those around us, and the blame is never towards a gender exactly. You know, it's not men who are making this happening, it's just the mind state that we're all in, putting that acknowledgement forward and how women can move themselves to be in a political voicing phase in their lives is really important. And I think a lot of young women, young black women, young queer black women are really, you know, getting out there like the Black Lives Matter movement and really politicizing these issues and saying we're done, we're ya basta, we want freedom and we're going to fight for it, but you know, with a lot of tact, realizing where people have been and where we're trying to go.
Especially that now you're seeing all the killings, the murder of men of color, and it's leaving all the women to nature, the children. So they should have a voice and educate the children and see and let the children see them out there. So, you know, we can have heroes and sheroes, or can we say uniroles, you know? And that's the message that needs to be put out. And I'm glad that the social forum is accepting that, or this world, this community is starting to embrace women speaking out, doing things on their own.
Yeah, I really think, I think that's one thing that can continue to be improved within the U.S. Social Forum is just that women, I think, need to continue to bring their stories to a politicized level and perspective. I mean, I think when Black Lives Matter movement started, it was, you know, really trying to voice and say women are also being killed by the cops. Black trans women are also being killed by the cops. So I think it's really, you know, saying the leadership of these women that, you know, don't want it to happen to them is coming out. And I think that struggle that needs to continue to happen is to say, if you don't feel you're politicized or you're political, you, the moment you start talking, that's when you're political. That's when you've got voice, and that's when we got your back. Collaborate and listen and hear, especially from the black community, and you know, especially the radical elements of the black community. I really think that is the key, and supporting it and harnessing it and knowing that, yes, it is about love, but it's very much about justice.
Is there any other thing you would like to say? I thank you for bringing that out to the community and the listening audience. Is there one last thing you want to make us aware of or you want to inform us on?
I think that'll do. I'm really excited to be here and learn and talk with folks.
Okay. Thank you much.
Welcome, welcome to all of you listening to Right to Survive Radio here on KBOO. I'm Lisa Fay, and I'm happy that you have joined us. Coming up in part two from San Jose, which is the second part of our U.S. Social Forum series, we will hear from Robert, the unofficial mayor, as he calls himself, of the jungle, and a 64-year young lady named Eva Marie, who survived living in the jungle as a single woman, often hungry, and has dealt with multiple health issues. Eva Marie is one of the fortunate few who were assisted into housing. The jungle, at its peak, had over 300 residents, many living near the stream. All lived in makeshift shelters, tents, abandoned trailers, and a few tree houses. The city did not provide sanitation, porta potties, or general assistance. The residents fed for themselves, and a few local organizations would come and give limited support services. It's important to note that the jungle San Jose was right in the middle of the heart of Silicon Valley, one of the richest communities in California and the nation. Because of the large salaries and the high-tech jobs, the rents, even in the poorer neighborhoods, were and are still skyrocketing, making living in an apartment an unattainable desire instead of a human right for most houseless people. But before we hear from Robert and Eva, we are going to bring you two stories covered by media on the jungle. The first is from Telesur, A Real USA, feature reporting by Rachel Silverman, as she interviews Andrew Costa, Yolanda Gutierrez, Raymond Bromson, and Sandy Perry. Then we go right into a short documentary piece produced by Mother Jones with commentary from Josh. So let's get back to our show. All I'm gonna say is that
Jose in Northern California recently ordered the eviction of a homeless encampment just minutes from Silicon Valley. Home to technology giants like Google and Apple, it's one of the wealthiest regions in the United States. Our correspondent Rachel Silverman has more.
This shantytown called the Jungle was home for years to hundreds of people living rough amongst rotting trash, rats, and human waste. Now they're waiting by the side of the road with everything they own piled into garbage bags and shopping carts. Former resident Andrew Costa says these people have been through very tough times.
They're part of the society that are discarded. They're your son that can't get a job. They're your daughter that takes too much drugs and it's not understood. The ones that didn't want to go to school. They're runaway people.
The city of San Jose is evicting the homeless from this 68-acre park, and work crews have come in with bulldozers to clear out the mismatched belongings they've left behind. Some people have lived here for years.
It's like a big family. We all looked out for each other, especially the females that are single. We all had our own little group and we check up on each other. But unfortunately, with what they did to us today, it's like they split the family apart.
But city officials say the encampment has been a dangerous place.
There's been increasing acts of violence. Victimization of the homeless people that are living here. With the wet weather coming, we're concerned about flooding conditions. We're concerned about people's general health and well-being.
City officials have also been under pressure from state and regional water authorities to clean up the trash and human waste. They committed $4 million to move as many jungle residents as possible into subsidized housing. But after a year and a half long effort, many of the residents were unable to find housing indoors.
I think it's a disgrace, and it's an example of the total failure of our city's housing policies as well as our state and our nation. We've abandoned a whole section of our people, and we don't take care of them. We allow them to sleep outside. We don't build the housing that they need.
San Jose has the country's highest percentage of unsheltered homeless, meaning people with no car, no family, or friends with whom to seek refuge. And on moving day, many of the jungle's former residents had been unable to find housing. They stood with their belongings, wondering where to go.
Where are you going to go today?
I don't know. Where are we going to go, Lily?
I don't know.
We don't know.
Work crews plan to spend 2 weeks clearing the jungle. It will likely take its former residents longer than that to find and settle into their new accommodation. Rachel Silverman for Telesur in San Jose, California.
Clara County is often portrayed as a role model for the rest of the country. The county has some of the highest salaries and most expensive real estate in America, thanks in large part to the phenomenal success of tech companies such as Google, Yahoo, Intel, Adobe, and of course Apple, the nation's wealthiest and most profitable company. But Santa Clara County also has a more unseemly distinction. I'm standing near downtown San Jose, inside what is by some accounts the largest homeless encampment in America. The jungle, as it's known, occupies a 65-acre stretch of creek where about 300 people live in makeshift structures. It's less of a homeless encampment than a full-blown shantytown.
This being the largest homeless encampment in the United States, and with us having Silicon Valley with Steve Jobs and all this cash, we're not supposed to have this kind of homeless problem. You know what I mean?
I don't get shot with a Kelly gun like 4 times, attacked with baseball bats, my house set on fire.
This is like hell on earth. I mean, this is like something you will not see. You have to see to believe, actually. It's like fourth world conditions.
A place called the jungle. Have you heard of it?
We're not making enough money really for conventional homes or housing, and we make too much money for subsidized homes. So we're kind of, you know, floating between the oil and the water.
We told the landlady here if it would be possible to continue staying here. She said, no, you better go. I already rented it out. We went and loaded things into a storage facility, and it's still there. And all the campgrounds and things that we saw were too far out of the city, you know, like KOAs and that sort of thing. So what we decided to do was to move into the jungle. So that's what we did.
A few days ago, a woman named Lydia Hernandez was robbed inside of her tent. When she refused to hand over the money, the robbers slit her throat. When she still fought back, they bashed her head with an axe. She died a few hours later. Residents say that the police never come into the jungle, so they have to fend for themselves.
There's no law down there except our own, right? There's no law. So we could smoke dope all day in the open. You know, the dope dealers ain't scared because, you know, they're secure.
We go to the Fairmont Hotel and have a brunch or do a philanthropy. That's not going to cut it. We need billions of dollars to go into the inner cities and go into the jungle. Silicon Valley, the Bay Area, is known for its innovation, its progressive thinking. It's one of the most progressive pockets in the United States, if not the world, and certainly one of the wealthiest. If we can't do it here, it won't happen anywhere. It's got to happen here.
Ibrahim Mubar from Right to Survive Radio on KBOO 90.7 FM on your radio dial. And today we're in San Jose, California at the U.S. Social Forum. And today I'm here with
Robert Aguirre.
Robert Aguirre, what brings you to the Social Forum today?
Well, I'm a advocate, organizer, and activist for the homeless in Santa Clara County.
And how long you been doing this type of work or gig?
Well, I've been doing this in this particular area for about a year, but I've been involved in social justice for much of my life.
And tell me, how are the people here treated that's living on the street that's been displaced from hell?
Well, there's a lot of criminalization of homeless. There's a lot of negative attitude, a very strong NIMBY culture that goes on here. We have a society here where we are one of the wealthiest, I think we are the wealthiest county in the United States, and this was also the home for the largest homeless encampment in the United States. So it's a tale of two cities, basically, where you have the haves and the have-nots, and the have-nots are growing larger and larger every year.
So, I didn't notice I was walking past a sign that said, Welcome to San Jose, capital of Silicon Valley. I didn't know that.
Yeah, well, this is pretty much where everything really got started, and San Jose is pretty much the housing community for the Silicon Valley, so people live here, but they go work in Mountain View, or they go work in Palo Alto, or different places all over, even San Francisco. And you see these huge buses that bus people around all the time. They're private buses that are owned by Cisco and Google and eBay and all. And well, they're not owned by them, but they're contracted to bring their employees in. The people that can't afford to live here actually live somewhere else, and then they're bussed in and they're bussed out. But they're private buses.
You would think that if this is the capital, Silicon Valley, which everybody using Twitter, Facebook, the internet, the cell phone, just like America, supposed to be the richest, powerful country in the world. And it shows that homelessness is everywhere, housing is everywhere. Wouldn't that be something that these rich 1% of people can do about houselessness here?
Well, there's a difference between will and ability. Okay, so if you have an ability and you have no will, then it's never going to happen. Okay, so it takes the will. And what has happened here is you have these companies that pay their employees very, very high salaries. And because they are paid high salaries, they can afford to pay higher rents. And what ends up happening is the landlords realize that they put an ad in, you know, Craigslist or wherever, and they'll get a bunch of different people coming and applying, and they just bid against each other until eventually the rents are raised so high that the average working person who works for one of the contractors that, for example, provides landscaping or kitchen help or custodial help, they cannot afford to live here because they aren't paid the same kind of salary. And therefore, they get priced out of the market and eventually end up either having to move out of the area or lose their homes completely.
So what we're talking about is what every city is talking about. Things is not affordable for the common person.
That's true, but this is the focal point. This is the origin of all that. Because this is where all those dot-com companies came from. This is where all those electronic companies came from. Intel and, you know, AMD and, you know, Shugart. All the early computer industry started here, and then it turned into the dot-com industry, and then that turned into these, like, Facebook, the social social media, and we also have a lot of biotech going on here, Genentech and so forth. And so these new technologies that are coming in are creating millions and millions of millionaires as these companies go public. So there's a lot of money that's being generated here. But unfortunately, most of these companies are incorporating outside of the United States. So therefore, they're not paying their fair share of taxes. And then so now the infrastructure starts to crumble because we don't have the support of these companies that are given pretty much a tax break to be able to stay here. And they threaten to leave if you're going to raise their taxes. So they're kind of holding the city hostage. But it's a moral dilemma, and it's creating a serious housing crisis of which likes no one has ever seen before. And we're starting to see little glimpses of that throughout the country. For example, in Detroit, you had the auto industry, and you know what happened there, demise just totally decimated that whole area. And you know, Flint, Michigan, same thing happened there. And you know, it's happening across the country in little pockets here and there. But this is right here continues to grow because there's new innovation, there's new business, there's new money that's coming in. So that continues to spin. And as it continues to spin, more and more people are getting spun off and they're getting lost in the process.
Like when I was young, we used to have pop the whip, everybody grab hands, and
right.
The last person gets spun off, and then the last person, right. You ain't grabbing on that strong enough. Now tell us, I mean, it's been lots of misconception about these cities come up with these great plans to help the houseless community. Like in Utah, they supposed to put everybody in houses first, but they perceived they was going to put everybody in there, going to get this money and put all the houseless people in homes first, and it didn't happen. Only a little bit of that population went. Tell us what happened when they closed the jungle down.
Well, at the time of closing the jungle, they decided that they were going to provide 200 housing vouchers. There were 300 people that were living there, so they, from the very beginning, they didn't have enough to really solve the problem. And if the city were going to be planning a park, for example, they wouldn't come up with 2/3 of the money and then start building the park. They would wait till they had all the money and then actually do that. They didn't do that with the jungle. They were getting a lot of pressure from the Water Quality Control Board and the regional offices in Oakland. We went and talked to them, and they said, well, we didn't tell them to shut the jungle down. We told them to clean it up. And so their way of cleaning it was just getting the people out of there. And if you've ever been back there again, you'll see that it's never been cleaned. It still has a lot of pollution and things that are there. So they haven't really gone back and done what they should have done. And the other thing that happened is when they ran everybody out of here, and I professed this before it happened, homelessness soon coming to a neighborhood near you. And this is exactly what happened. And people started going out to all different parts of the city, and they were going to neighboring cities. And as a matter of fact, the mayor was suggesting that people go to Gilroy, which is in the South County. The mayor of Gilroy didn't appreciate it, but, you know, a lot of people did go. As a matter of fact, their numbers have risen by 213, according to the 2015 point of time count that was done. So we know some of the people have gone that way. But the other thing that has happened is that people have become more and more separated, and that creates a lot of tension amongst people, a lot of distrust, because you don't have a community of people that you can have near you, that you can watch your back. And so consequently, there's all this survival mode that people are in, and they can't really work on their individual problems. And it just creates a lot of chaos. And in turn, because they're being chased from place to place, which I call whack-a-mole, and they get chased to another place. And every time they get chased, it costs the city around $10,000. So there's a lot of money that's being spent and no result, because people don't want them in their backyard. But as soon as they get chased out, they're in someone else's neighborhood. And then they get chased out into someone else's neighborhood. And this is just a game that goes on and on with no real result at the end.
So you say it's like 300 people and it costs $10,000 to chase at least one person out of a neighborhood. Do the math, folks. They spend all that money. Why can't they get land to have an encampment site where people can build community and become productive?
Well, this area is probably one of the most expensive areas for real estate. And you go and you look at a property, and if you see something that's selling for $100,000, you're probably just paying for the front lawn. You know, you're not really buying the property itself. So what ends up happening is you end up with a lot of people that can't afford to buy property. And the city is trying to do whatever they can to try to help out, but there's just no property available, and private owners aren't interested in selling or renting to homeless people, even though they themselves are not paying for it. They know that eventually they're going to be moving in. As a matter of fact, there's a lot of negativity towards people with Section 8 vouchers. And as I mentioned earlier, the 200 vouchers for the jungle, they were only able to house 144 people at the closing of the jungle because there's no housing available. Even with the vouchers and all the programs and the case management and all the wonderful things that they thought they were going to do, they still were unable to meet their goal. And even today with the Housing 1000 program, they haven't been able to house 1,000 people. They've housed 847 or something like that people. So they can't even do it with their resources. What chance do people on their own have?
Are people being criminalized for sleeping on the streets, or is it in public restrooms or places they can take showers? Is it illegal to feed people here that living on the streets or sidewalk?
Well, there are a few spotty places around town where people can go take showers. There's a few places where people go and they can use the restrooms, but most businesses have these little signs up that say, you know, you have to be a customer and we reserve the right to refuse service. And, you know, so there's a 7-Eleven that I know of that just refuses to do business with homeless people. They don't care how much money you have, whatever. A guy bought 5 pizzas and police had to come and escort him out and had him wait out in front while they cooked his pizzas, and then they delivered it to him outside because they didn't want him inside. I mean, this is the sort of thing that goes on here. It's wrong. Yesterday, I got a phone call from somebody who was given a ticket for trespassing that was on a walking trail, and it's just because they were homeless, right? So there's a lot of criminalization of people, all sorts of different things. There's a park close by here. It's called St. James Park, and they have a sign up there, and item number 15 says no feeding or giving of clothing to people, and that's because the churches come there and they do that. Well, the churches are exercising their religious right to be able to do that. I mean, they're commanded to do this sort of thing by their faith, and yet the city has got this rule up there. And what I did is I went and I pointed out to them that rule, that law has not, that ordinance has not been passed. So even though it's not been passed, they have the sign there, and the park rangers go and point to it and tell the people, you can't serve food here, you can't give out food here, because look, it's written right here. But just because it's written there doesn't mean anything. So what I do is I educate people, and through education, through knowledge, you can beat these people, because they themselves don't even know that. So I tell them exactly where to go on the internet so they can look it up, and they can say, look, you see, it says pending. Pending does not mean that it's been passed. It means that it's waiting to be passed or waiting to fail.
And, you know, just on this note, I just heard you say that no feeding people, no giving them clothing. Don't that sound like when you go to the zoo, don't feed the animals, don't pet the animals?
Well, that's true. And as a matter of fact, it's really sad, too, because we do have busloads of people that come by and they take pictures and they stop and they look at encampments and, you know, let's go see what the monkeys are doing today, you know, that sort of thing. And people do encourage people to help homeless people. But what ends up happening is people massage their guilt by coming on holidays. For example, on Thanksgiving, we had more food than we knew what to do with. People were showing up with turkeys and pies and all that. And down in the jungle, I was walking around and I saw an entire pie with just a handful of pie taken out of it, and the rest of the pie was thrown away because it was too much food on one day. And I implored people. I said, please come back tomorrow or come back next week. Don't do it all today. And people were insisting on doing it because all they're trying to do is just assuage their guilt.
Yeah. So have you ever heard about RAP in San Francisco, Western Recency Advocacy Project? And if not, they're doing something called the Homeless Bill of Rights.
Right.
And right now they program the Right to Rest Bill. And have you doing any work with them?
As a matter of fact, I did go to Sacramento on that. And Senator Jim Bell was a head of that committee. And we went and we spoke. It was probably about 50 or 60 people that spoke to that. And then they offered the people from the businesses to have an opportunity to speak. And every time we have these types of discourses with people, on not just on this subject, but anything having to do with homelessness or rental rights or anything like that, the people with the money always talk about protecting their money. And, you know, this is our investment and we're going to lose money and all this stuff. And we're talking about people's lives here. We're not talking about money. We're talking about the right to rest, the right to have a place to live, the right to not have your rent raised so much that you can no longer afford to live there. There was a story that came out in Los Angeles yesterday, I believe, where some guy had rents for $1,800 something a month for these apartments. And then the next day he raised it to $3,000. Okay, that's a huge jump. But the reason he did that is because he wants those people to move away so that he can sell the property. We have the same thing going on here in Palo Alto with a mobile home park, Buena Vista Park, where the owner decided he wanted to sell it. And the people said, okay, the property's worth about $12 million. We'll raise it $12 million and give it to you. And he says, well, no, I have this developer over here. He wants to pay me $35 million for it because he's going to put in this high rise and the values are going to go up. So we're going to pay you guys the value that it is today so that you can leave. And then I'm going to turn around and sell it and I'm going to make all this money, right? And I don't care where you go, just don't go here. So this is a sort of attitude that people are having where they're more focused on their own greed. And, you know, I weep for this nation. We are steadily going downhill in a handbasket and there's no brakes. We're just losing it.
There you go, folks. I was saying it all along, corporate rights supersedes human rights. Thank you very much. This is Ibrahim Mubarak from Right to Survive Radio on KBOO 90.7 out of Portland, Oregon. And today we're in San Jose, California at the U.S. Social Forum. And today I'm here with
Eva Marie Martinez.
Eva, how long have you been houseless?
15 years off and on, yes.
And you was part of the big sweep, they call it, of the houseless encampment site called the Jungle. Can you describe some of that happening and why?
Okay, I was there for a year and a half. I was living down on the part of the jungle, but due to my physical issues and my age, I had to go up on the upper level. And it was a lot of sadness in there because of the folks that were down there and the way they were living and the way they were surviving. And also myself, when I was there, you know, they became family to me and friends, and we all learned to live together and help one another. A lot of sadness, though, because the way we were living there, I mean, there's times that we wouldn't have no food, and we'd have to go try and get food on our own, and I would take my shopping cart to recycle to get a little bit of food for the day, and seeing others with their children, it was very sad, and the children struggling, and there was also animals, the dogs, you know, which didn't have no food, and they were struggling for themselves and the folks that had them, and there was good times when we would be fed warm meals. Folks would come with their meals, their vehicles or their trucks, and they would serve us hot meals, or we'd get cold meals, like sometimes we'd get sandwiches and water. And other times we were lucky too, like on a Sunday, some gentlemen, they'd come with their vehicles with KFC and pizza and soda, so it was a blessing on that one. I'm now living indoors after a year and a half, and I'm grateful because I have a lot of physical issues. I have asthma and bronchitis, and I live indoors now, and I'm very happy, and I have a place of my own now to shower and cook and, you know, sleep peacefully now.
So during your stay in the jungle, was social services coming there trying to get people housed, or any other type of agencies or faith-based community coming there to bring porta potties or trash bags for the trash, or to bring food, or to get you off to get into a good stable place?
Well, yes, there is agencies, and the one I have, her name's Teresa Nava. I owe her a lot because she's the one that's gotten me this far indoors, and she stuck through me through thick and thin, and the same here with me. I stuck by her side thick and thin. There was good days, bad days, where I was hoping I'd get indoors sooner, which I didn't, but there was a services that was called the street teams that would go down there, but they wouldn't really clear out all the trash because there were so many. I believe there's more than 200 and some folks living in the jungle, and with animals and plus their children, and it was very hard for us to ever keep it really in order with the trash. And there was others, I mean, folks, I mean, kind of desperate, tearing the bags open to see whatever they could get, you know, leftovers of the food. That's how they were surviving also. And porta potties, we had them maybe at the last when we were actually 86 out of there. Everyone, they had the porta potties maybe, I'd say maybe for 2 weeks, but they'd pick them up every night to clean them out. I'm grateful too that we had a medical bus, and Mercy, which she's a nurse. She's the one that actually cared for me a lot because I have my disabilities, kind of pneumonia and bronchitis. And I owe it to her because she did save my life for sending me off to the hospital.
So what you're saying, it was houseless people dumpster diving and other houseless people's garbage just to eat?
Yes, sir, yes, because it was hard for them. I could see them. It was so sad. It used to make me cry. I would sometimes turn. If I had extra food or clothing, I would share it with them because they were family to me.
Was it a governing body that people did community policing or community accountability?
Sometimes and sometimes not, yes.
Did y'all have a code of conduct, like no drugs, alcohol, no theft, no fighting?
Well, that was very hard to really like put into words because everyone, they needed their needs. If they didn't have water or food, I mean, they would go to drinking, or, you know, it was sad to see them do that, but because there was times I would not even have water myself.
So people was really on survival mode, and sometimes survival mode make you selfish, huh?
Yes, sir. Yes, yes, because people would sometimes close their tents up, and when they come back, they'd be open, and people, I guess, believe would get into their tents and get whatever they can, clothing or food or whatever they could, you know, scrounge up.
What would happen when a conflict broke out? How would that be solved?
Usually there would be the people out there, they would have like their own security or their backup, or they would control the arguments and what have you, which is a really good thing to have over there.
So can you tell the listening audience the whole concept of the jungle being swept and what was promised and the promise, the lies and everything about the whole cleaning up the area?
Well, the city would always promise that they would, you know, find us a place from the jungle when we had to get out of there to have another secure place for a while or what have you. It was just false promises. They didn't accumulate us or nothing. nothing to help us. So when we had to get out of there, it was mostly the folks around, everybody that was living there was helping one another. Actually, because at the end, when we did at 86, the police were there. They didn't help us, and I'm disabled, and I was walking in mud where I was almost slipping and sliding. I could have hurt myself, and I'm 64, and it was really sad to see everybody, and it was raining. It was muddy. It was so muddy out there, and the police were just, like, pushing people out of there. They wouldn't help. They were not helping at all. They didn't. They were just standing in a whole line, like, and laughing at folks out there, you know, people. You know, it was really sad to see that.
They picked the worst day to move people with nowhere to go into a worse situation, and raining and mud and slipping. They couldn't say, well, let's wait till the weather is better.
Oh, no, they didn't know. They just wanted everyone out of there. Rain or shine, they just evicted everybody, threw us all out. And the workers came with the bulldozers right away, and whatever you could salvage, that was it. If not, it was gone.
All your sentimental values and personal stuff and IDs and clothes and everything.
Everything, yes. Everything, whatever you could salvage, whatever you couldn't. I mean, it was at the last minute, and they were stating like a day ahead that, oh, we'd come, they were going to be there like 8 o'clock, give us time. They were there like 4:30 in the morning, police and all, police and all.
And people just falling asleep, my goodness, wow. To your knowledge, how many people do you think the city lived up there to their promise? And it was like 350 people in the jungle. So how many of those 350 people exactly got housed? And not put in shelters, but into their own place.
Out of that many, I would say, not including myself, thank God, I would say out of that 300 or whatever, maybe at the most, I'd say maybe 25.
My goodness.
I'm just saying 25. It was probably less.
So where are these people now? Where are the houseless people?
Well, they scattered them all over, like towards Santa Teresa, Blossom Hill. They're just all scattered everywhere, different places, you know. And I'm just thankful that I got a place where I'm closer to the hospital because of my physical issues.
Yeah.
And the bus stop, a supermarket. But everyone from the ones I've known that got a place, they were just all scattered different places. And the folks that lived there in the area, or they didn't know anyone around them. So they were like, they were lost. Like, and they kept going like towards back to the jungle to see their friends, their family. I consider everybody that they were my friends that I got to know, and friends and family. It was kind of scary for them because they had no transportation, no money, and they were just out there just because they had a place, but they didn't know no neighbors or no one.
So we thank you, and we very, very happy that you got inside, and hopefully plenty more. And you look so beautiful today.
Thank you.
I know you're happy. So any one last thing you want to say to the listening audience?
Thank you for listening, and God bless you all, and I hope you never have to go through what I did or others, my family from the jungle, and God bless you all.
Searching garbage for the food I eat. You pretend that you're deaf and dumb. Don't you know that you could be the next one?
As we wrap up another hour of Right to Survive Radio, I'd like to thank everyone who helped put this show together, including our interviews and our interviewers and the media and their production. Also, we would like to thank local organizations and donors who assisted in our raising the funds to be able to attend the U.S. Social Forum 3. To cover the forum and obtain our stories while learning and sharing the experiences of a broad spectrum of activists, all uniting for social justice. Additional notes to the jungle include some of the former residents that are still trying to stay together, moved across town under a freeway underpass, and are calling a new camp the village. Secondly, and sadly, of the 300 plus residents from the jungle, a small number, between 25 and 50 people, actually receive some type of housing. Please tune in next month as we interview houseless people who were invited to do a boat tour of the Willamette River Superfund cleanup site, along with speakers from the EPA and local environmental justice activists working in Portland for the health of our rivers.
I know you.
You've been listening to Right to Survive Radio here on KBOO 90.7 on your radio dial with Lisa Faye and Ibrahim Mubarak. Right to Survive show come to you the second Wednesday of every month at 6 p.m. here on KBOO.
Right to Survive holds meetings the second and fourth Thursday of the month at Sisters of the Road Cafe, located on Northwest 6th and Davis from 5 to 7 p.m.
Right to Survive can be followed on Facebook, YouTube, Wix, or from archives from KBOO. Reach out to us through email. It's r2spdx@gmail.com. That's r2spdx@gmail.com or by phone 503-839-9992.
Join us at City Hall every Wednesday through November 25th for 9 a.m. rallies to end houselessness and fight against evictions of renters, for affordable housing, and for the city to stop the sweeps against the houseless people of our community.
We would love for you, our audience, to get involved. We have many ways you can volunteer with our organization, Right to Survive and Right to Dream Too.
We have a huge benefit coming up on October 17th from 6 to 9:30 p.m. at the Independent Publishing Resource Center T, located near 10th and Division. As core members of Western Regional Advocacy Project, we are hosting a concert featuring rap artist Mike Crenshaw to celebrate 10 years of organizing around housing and human rights. Tickets start at $10 and can be purchased through the raphome.org website. That's WRAP home.org, or through brown paper tickets. We look forward to meeting our audience and getting to know our listeners while coming out to support great works in our community and have fun and dance to some awesome music. Thank you for tuning in tonight. This is Lisa Faye
and Ibrahim Mubarak
saying thank you for enjoying our show, and remember to be kind to somebody
and help a houseless person if it's just talking with you.
Good night.
No moral ambiguity, all the ingenuity, thoroughly directed at war with your community. No matter what they do to me, it won't change the fact. Freedom's a human right, it's time to take them back.
Somebody help me.
That's word.
This is not healthy.
Oh, man.
I am not wealthy.
What I do, have the power to break the chains.
Doing what's right, you
might.
Life is your
life, might get you.
They want you to think it's
suicide, y'all, but we gonna change the game.
So the characteristics of an American mystic in a materialistic authoritarian system. As far as human relations, we know the master plan includes self-determination for all Africans. Coming from a deficit on the edge of a precipice, exploited by greed and racial prejudice. I'm President Obama, Iraq to Pakistan. I'm marching in Detroit to take back the land. A submerged serpent's coil purges oil. The dispersants further poison the oceans and soil. The merchants of death are certainly loyal. To murder for profit, the whole earth is a broiler. So how do we stop this obnoxious nonsense? A meeting, a forum, a concert, a conference. I understand the need to talk and process, but we need action, not just thoughts and concepts.
Somebody help me.
That's
a
word.
This is not healthy.
Oh, man.
I am not wealthy.
What I do, have the power to break the chains.
Doing what's right, you
might.
Life is your
might get you.
They want you to think it's
suicide, y'all, but we gonna change the game.
The time is 6:59. You're tuned to KBOO Portland. That was Right to Survive Radio. Up next is Hard Knock. First, we have some words for you.
The Western Regional Advocacy Project is celebrating 10 years of fighting for affordable housing and against the criminalization of people who are homeless. KBOO is a proud co-sponsor of the RAP 10-year anniversary concert featuring Mike Crenshaw, Saturday, October 17th at 6 p.m. at the Independent Publishing Resource Center. RAP is a national leader in both street outreach and grassroots organizing against homelessness. KBOO will be live streaming the concert from our website. Again, that's the RAP 10-year anniversary concert, Saturday, October 17th, 6 p.m. at the Independent Publishing Resource Center, located at 1001 Southeast Division Street in Portland. For more information, go to kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under KBOO Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is seeking an individual or group to contract with to help build our next 3-year strategic plan. KBOO embodies equitable social change, shares knowledge, and fosters creativity by delivering locally rooted and diverse music, culture, news, and opinions with a commitment to the voices of oppressed and underserved communities. We've been serving the Portland community since 1968 and are one of the oldest independent community radio stations in the country. The person or group who is selected will co-lead the development of a strategic plan with the KBOO Strategic Planning Support Work Group, made up of volunteers, board members, and staff. More details about the application process can be found at kboo.fm/planrfp.